Guardian Unlimited.
Hello and welcome along to the Guardian Haycast. I'm Safraz Manzoor with your one-stop guide to the best of the Hay Festival. Now, the bank holiday madness might be over, but Hay is still bustling with book lovers. As you walk into the entrance, you're greeted by a long list of all the events which are sold out. For example, Bob Geldof, if you want tickets for that, that's sold out. William Hague, Mark Knopfler, the list literally does go on. But there are tickets obviously available for most other events, and as you walk through the entrance, you turn to your right, you go to the ticket sales, and you speak to somebody like Tom. Now, Tom, what are the most popular events today in terms of tickets?
Today, the most popular events have been Sebastian Faulks and probably Bob Geldof. Both of them have sold out.
Are people pretty desperate for something? And if they haven't got them, what happens?
People have been kind of hanging around the box office waiting for return tickets. There's been a couple of people walking up and down through the queues trying to ask people if they've got tickets for sale and things.
So if somebody's incredibly determined and incredibly irritating, there's nothing they can be done about it?
We always try and sort them out some way. If it's not with the event that they want to go and see, try and point them in another kind of similar event or something like that.
Thanks for that, Tom. Now, among the authors who were sold out was Sebastian Faulks. Faulks is probably most famous for his best-selling historical novels like Birdsong and Charlotte Gray, but his latest, Engleby, begins in the 70s before moving to the present. When I met Sebastian Faulks, he began with a reading from Engleby.
This is a bit from Engleby where the main character, Mike, is at university. And this is fairly typical of the way that he thinks about things. It's all quite logical and natural, but maybe slightly off-key. A pair of goofy scientists came swaggering into the Kestrel at lunchtime one day many years ago to say that, just an hour earlier, they'd figured out the shape of human chemistry, of the molecule itself. I don't think the boozers in the Kestrel were impressed. I don't think this discovery was an answer to any of the top 100 questions that the Kestrel regulars would have liked an answer to, even if you allow for the fact that numbers 1 to 15 were probably whose round is it. That's part of the trouble with science. It doesn't always help. I don't find it useful to know that particles may appear in different places without having travelled the distance in between. I don't find it enlightening that the only truthful way of thinking of Herr Schrödinger's cat is as being simultaneously alive and dead. In fact, I don't believe it is the only truthful way of thinking of it. It may be the only logical way of thinking of it, but that's a different matter, isn't it? The real problem, though, is that I don't recall asking after the welfare of his cat in the first place.
Sebastian Faulks, was inhabiting a character like Mike Engleby easier or harder than the historical ventriloquism that you're more famous for? And did the fact that there were more parallels between the life of somebody like Engleby and yours make it easier or more of a challenge?
In a way, Mike was very easy to do because he came and found me, and you used the word ventriloquism, but it was rather the opposite. I was the medium through which he spoke, and I wrote the book in a very different way from the way that I've normally proceeded. And his voice came first. I've never written in the first person before. I normally find if I write I or we, I immediately become rather paralysed and self-conscious and self-aware. But the good thing about this voice, which just came to me, and I just started writing down exactly how it came to me without knowing where I was headed. The good thing about Mike's voice was that it was completely distinct from me, and I could use the pronoun I. And I could say my and mine without this sense of it being in any way me at all. And it was a perfectly secure, watertight, impermeable little pipe that ran down through my brain somewhere deep into my unconscious or wherever stories are found. And so that was very exhilarating because there's something, obviously, there's a directness and an impact that a first-person narration has, which the third-person just doesn't. There also, of course, it imposes limitations. Everything is told from one point of view. Though I get around that a bit in Engleby by having a counterpoint to Mike's voice, which is the voice of a young woman called Jennifer, who is in many ways rather the opposite of him. She's someone who's rather good at being alive. She does happy. She does communication with other people. She likes other people, which Mike doesn't. It was, in an odd technical way, it was easy for me, this voice, and the voice is the thing. It's the most important part of the book. And there is no research, really, in this book, because he's the same age as me. So I remember when the film or the music or the book that he refers to came out, and I didn't really need to bother to check.
When you talk about this particular voice and you talk about the particular location and time that this is set, this is obviously different from Birdsong and Charlotte Gray and hugely successful novels. Does it take courage to follow the voice?
Well, I was doubtful about it. But when I got to work the first day and Mike had basically given me a page, that was given, then I thought, well, is that it? But I found it wasn't, and it would go on. And basically I was able to replug and reconnect to this guy every day. And I was a bit unsure about how much time to give this, because what you dread as a novelist really is spending a year on something and you get to about page 150, page 200, and you realise you haven't really got a novel. It is insufficiently rich. There isn't enough going on. There aren't enough themes and ideas in it, and which is why I always plan my books very carefully. But with this, I thought, well, I've got nothing else on, so I'll just run with it. This was in September, and I said, I'll run with it till Christmas. Then if it's no good, if it's gone nowhere, fine. I just put it down to experience. Anyway, by Christmas, I'd almost finished. And the experience was good because it showed me a different way of writing, and I gave much more credence, I gave much more foreground to what was coming out of an unconscious part of my mind than I normally do.
He's also a bit of an anti-hero, isn't he? He doesn't seem to, as you say, he doesn't seem to like people. He doesn't seem to like the present. Not a particularly nice person to want to spend time with.
No, he's not. Mike isn't a likeable character, but I think he's an interesting character. I hope so. I mean, the thing with... I've been rather shocked by how much people do like him, actually. Particularly, oddly enough, women readers seem to feel more sympathetic to him than men. And you get that sort of divide, which is very bizarre in fiction, where women seem to extend more latitude towards men and vice versa. It reminded me of the Forsyte saga, which was when I was a child. There was this big... did split the nation when Soames Forsyte forced himself on his wife. And most of the women watchers said, well, you know, she shouldn't have married him if she didn't want to have sex. And men were appalled at this act of violence that he'd made. So it's rather like that in Engleby, people's different responses to him. But people are very amoral, and they have, in their indulgence of fictional characters, they just want to be interested. They want to be amused. And I think that Mike is really a very modern guy in that his take on reality is very selective. And this is what I see in the streets where I live. People have an iPod in one ear, they're on the mobile phone in the other ear. They get a lot of information, but they don't really connect very much with their local community or with society as a whole. They are atomized in that perhaps rather sort of over-voguish word, but I think it's a good word which does describe it. And Mike is an atomized kind of guy. He knows a lot, but he doesn't really put it together, and he's unable to connect in any contributing way to the world at large.
Hello, I'm Ian Rankin,
and you're listening to The Guardian's Haycast. Guardian's Haycast.
Now, I'm back at the Guardian double-decker bus in the middle of the festival site, and with me is Charlotte Higgins. Now, Charlotte, you went to see Vivienne Westwood last night, and she was launching, I think, what she called it, her cultural manifesto. What does that mean in English?
Well, to be honest, Safras, it was quite hard to tell, because what she was saying was somewhat opaque. She had laid out her cultural manifesto in the form of a sort of Socratic dialogue, in which the interlocutors were people like Diogenes, the Cynic philosopher, Alice in Wonderland, Pinocchio, the Mad Hatter, and Aristotle. So it was kind of obliquely done. But as far as one could tell, she was trying to argue against the notion of subjectivity in art, and she was arguing for objectivity in art, and in particular for craft and skill in art, rather than just people putting up their hands and saying, I'm a conceptual artist. Well, here's a little bit of it now.
No art, no progress. We must find out, go in search of her. But wait, who is this with fire-cracking, smouldering pigtails, gold teeth, and a brace of flintlocks in his belt? He is a pirate, and what does his T-shirt say? I love crap.
So that was Vivian Westwood talking. The way you described it sounds like quite an interesting and perhaps challenging thing for the Hay audience. What kind of reaction did you gauge?
Well, most people in the audience kind of listened to it quietly, but some people were making their dissatisfaction felt quite obviously. So one man got up, stretched, yawned in a very exaggerated manner and left the room. Lots of people left. There was a bit of humming and hawing and a little bit of giggling, because she did keep going on, even though the chair, Diana Quick, the actress, did keep trying to stop her and bringing her back to answer questions. So it did lapse into comedy. But here's what some other people thought of the event.
I didn't think it was that good.
Why not?
Because we didn't really understand what she was talking about. It was nothing about fashion, so...
I actually don't know. What? It was about, like, Alice...
No, she was trying to tell us a story, but it was about Alice in Wonderland and stuff. Mm-hmm. We didn't actually have a clue.
I thought she seemed somewhat incoherent, but I was very excited to see her nonetheless. I thought her hairstyle was very exciting, as my husband asked her a very long and complex question, which she didn't really answer, and I was quite embarrassed. That was my Vivian Westwood experience.
Thanks, Charlotte. Now, Charlotte is, of course, immaculately and rather stylishly dressed, but what about the rest of the festival goers? How do you pack and what do you pack when you come to Hay? And is there even such a thing as a Hay look? Well, Nell Bose and Tishani Doshi walked around the festival to try and find out.
So, Tishani, it's pouring down around us. And what are people wearing?
Well, probably everything that they own in the suitcase, because it's freezing. And they've got wellies, which are a Hay favourite, muddy sneakers, anoraks, various different kinds of raincoats, waterproof trousers. He has a very smart red trench coat. That's Revel Guest, who's the Hay chair, and she's always quite trendy, actually, I've noticed. She doesn't seem to be letting the weather bother her at all. She's reading a book, she's eating a snack, she's got a billowy skirt on, nice coat, and wellies. That's quite brave.
We've got some really proper, pure Hay wellies going up along there.
Whole family of wellies, in fact.
Was that with Hay Gill, was it?
That was.
Ah.
That's my vote for sort of one of the most fashionable men at Hay, because he's always very smartly turned out.
I've forgotten what his name is. He's the writer.
Oh, let's have a coffee here, getting out of the cold.
Okay, good idea.
So, Tony, you always dress beautifully, impeccably.
Very kind of you.
How do you approach the Hay fashion dilemma?
Well, usually I bring a very big bag, and I come for the whole week, so I need to have a range of things for sort of warm weather, rainy weather, cold weather, nighttime things, daytime things. But I'm beginning to realise that the sort of the coolest way to do it is to actually pack as light as you can, but have sort of to be adaptable, so to have things, you know, so layering, and to have things that can sort of transform from daytime outfit into a nighttime outfit. So I haven't quite got the knack of that yet, but I've seen a few people who have. So yesterday, for instance, I saw someone and they looked sort of very businesslike and smart, a publisher. And then at night, she was sort of on the dance floor at the Harper's, dressed to thrill party in a very sort of slinky top. So she was wearing it all along. And so it was just a question of, you know, layering and camouflage. The thing is, I was talking to David Mitchell yesterday, and he said a funny thing about Welsh weather, which is that it's sort of like a striptease. It shows you a little bit of sun, a little bit of leg, and it's the same thing with sort of what you're wearing at Hay, because you have to kind of be prepared for all eventualities, because I think you want to be comfortable. I think that's the main thing. You don't want to be walking around in, you know, 6-inch sort of heel shoes in sort of muddy weather like this.
Have you seen anyone in 6-inch heels?
Actually, I have, in leopard print or tiger print red 6-inch heel shoes, which were, I thought, a bit over the top for Hay. But, you know,
people wearing hoodies and the Hay t-shirts around. Should we brave the weather and go and try and find them?
Yeah, I think let's go have a look at that.
Thank you.
Excuse me.
Hi, yes. Do you work here?
Are you helping?
We're doing a sort of a podcast on Hey Fashion, and we wanted to see your sort of merchandise and what you have on offer.
Yeah.
We've got a selection of hoodies, the charcoal hoodies, in ladies and gents sizes. We've got the four different quotes on all the T-shirts. We've got the Tony Benn, in my mind, It's Replaced Christmas. But I think the top favourite at the moment is the Hey On Why, Is That Some Kind of Sandwich by Arthur Miller.
That's my favourite, yeah.
So do you like them? Are you going to get one, Shani?
No, well, okay, this is the thing.
Do they have ladies? They have
the hoodies
sizes,
is £42, and the T-shirts are...
Well, the T-shirts are 16.
Well, that's not too bad.
So it's a very literary crowd here. So perhaps they're not focusing on fashion. Should they be more? Should they pull their socks off and actually try a bit harder? Or is that not the point of Hey?
No, I don't think they should. I think they should do what they feel like. Because I have to say, literary festivals in other parts of the world, even the Hey Festival, say in Italy or in, you know, Cartagena, people dress differently because it's all to do with the place. And I think Hey On Why is to do with being in Wales, being in the Brecon Beacons, being in the countryside, being where it's going to rain, and, you know, perhaps it will evolve a bit, and perhaps, you know, writers will sort of, you know, smarten up. But I don't think that should be the focus, no.
Haycast.
Haycast.
Guardians Haycast.
I'm Kieran Desai, and
I'm
you're
Dave
listening
Egbert.
To
Sebastian Lewis and the Guardians Haycast.
Finally on the Haycast, George Alagaya. Now, he's probably best known as a newsreader, but with his new book, A Home From Home, George Alagaya moves out of the studio and embarks on a journey across Britain and through his own past. It's a journey that begins in Sri Lanka, moves to Ghana, before finally ending in Britain. And when I met George Alagaya, I began by asking him about that journey and whether he's worried that an Hey audience only sees the final version of him.
Safra's... And I don't know if you feel this, but it's only really what I say now. I say as often as I can and as loud as I can, I am an immigrant. You see, for so much of my journey, I didn't say that. In fact, for so much of my journey, I tried to hide that. I mean, you couldn't, obviously, because I'm brown skinned. But for so much of my journey, I was fixated on the idea that I had to fit in. I came here as an 11-year-old boy into a boarding school. No mum and dad to go to, no sort of relatives or anything like that. So it was sink or swim. And it is actually very, very important for me anyway that, A, the people at places like Hey On Why understand that journey. And this is what I say to them. I mean, in fact, at the beginning of my talk, hopefully if the technology works, I'll show a little DVD. And these are photographs of me barefoot, in Vellavatta, in Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it used to be then, precisely because I'm trying to say to them, this is what migration's actually about. It's not just about a start and a finish, it's the process. And if we understood that process in all its power, in all its in all its poignancy, I think in our country we look at migration in a very different way.
Reading your book, I was struck by, in a sense, the price you pay for integrating and the price you pay. And it wasn't necessarily a price that you chose to pay, but by going to a boarding school, for example, the immersion, as you call it, the total immersion into English culture is very explicit. Was there ever a part of you that wanted to reconnect with some of your roots? And did you feel that you'd strayed too far from them to have something that's not quite yours, the idea of complete acceptance, but not quite having the Sri Lankan or the Guyanan route either?
I think that's happened more recently, and my whole this journey that I went back, this trip that I went back to Sri Lanka on 5-6 years ago, that was what it was about. I think reclaiming some of that past. I don't agree with you, by the way, about the total acceptance thing, because the thing about this country is that class trumps race, and if you get to where I am. And I say this reluctantly, but in the British establishment, you know, newsreader, big news programme, etc., etc., that puts you as part of the establishment. And every black and Asian person will know this, that if you're the right class, sometimes that can trump race. And so I think I am accepted, but not so much because they accept necessarily the colour, but because they accept the class.
But then that relates to the other point, because your book is not just memoir, it's also a journey of it's a journey, a reportage across Britain, and you're looking at Britain today. Now, because of your what you describe as yourself as an exceptional experience, and also because of your success, did you question your legitimacy about commenting on working class immigrants who haven't had the opportunities that you've had?
Yeah, I absolutely accept that, and so I make a real point in the book of saying I don't hold myself up as an example. I had compared to tens of thousands of immigrant children today, had a very privileged background. And my parents weren't rich, actually, and the school I went to, there was a boarding section. It was a state school. It was a grammar school, but nonetheless, it was very privileged. But what struck me, and I set out really to talk about my journey, and what struck me was that whether you like it or not, that boarding school experience gave me this total immersion, gave me this acceptance, in inverted commas. I suddenly realised, looking around me, that that wasn't the case for lots of other children, Asian children, who ought to be able to aspire to everything that you and I have aspired to and do what we have achieved. And I don't think they're going to be able to do it. And that's really the jumping off point. Not so much that I know what it is like to be working class and Asian, but I know what it can be like if you're where I am, and that I want to open up these opportunities for other children.
But it's also kind of an ironic thing, because your parents' generation, my parents' generation, they were the sort of people who came to Britain and had embraced quite a lot of Britain. They weren't forced to come here on the whole. They wanted to come here because there were opportunities and because they believed that there was going to be something better. And it's interesting that their children and their children's children have such an antagonistic view of the same country.
I think, I often wonder what my parents would have made of this country if they'd lived here with me, if we'd all lived in a house together, you know, some part of London, because I think the Britain they sent me to was the Britain of their mind, the Britain of the missionaries, the Britain of the kind of people they'd met when they were in Ghana, or indeed even way back in Ceylon. And I think what has happened is that for that first generation, there wasn't, by the way, any of the kind of props that make it possible to enjoy life here in terms of, you know, policies that came out of multiculturalism and so on. So they just had to fit in. They had to get on with it. And I think, in a sense, the reaction of young people today, some young people, perhaps, I don't know about many of them, but some young people, is they look at it and the promise isn't quite there. It isn't delivering for them. Now, part of the reason it doesn't deliver is racism, which I think exists then when I came and exists now, even more potent perhaps in some ways. Part of the reason is that. The other part of the reason is the bit I look at in the book, which is this multiculturalism gone wrong, where people are locked away in enclaves, and actually where there's that means there's a lack of opportunity.
Talking of enclaves, there aren't that many non-whites in Hay, are there? Why do you think that is?
Well, exactly. I mean, good question. And that's, you know, when I've just said there is racism in this country. Some of it is the headline racism that, you know, you and I cover as journalists. But all the below-the-line racism is still there in Hay. Every book festival I go to, every talk I give, I mean, you know, it's still... really, it's like-minded people from a particular racial group and from a particular class group, and we need to change that. And even institutions like the BBC, you know, there's or the Guardian, maybe. I mean, there's plenty of kind of people like me, Asians, black people, moving up in front of the camera. But where the big decisions are made, the decisions about how the corporation is managed, how is the money spent, who schedules what at what time of the day. Though in those kind of areas, there are very few Asian or black people. And that's why I say I think we've got a way to go yet.
And with success and with visibility, does responsibility come from that?
It does. I mean, it's something that I've, if I'm honest about it, accepted somewhat reluctantly. And I think that's been a mistake in my life. I didn't think I understood early enough in my career. And I was, after all, the first Asian, or perhaps even black, foreign correspondent of the BBC. I don't think I understood the extent to which that was an important thing to do, not just for me, but to my people, if I can put it that way. And you know, when I was getting awards, I used to think, well, do I want to be the best black journalist or the best Asian? I just want to be a really good journalist. And now I've come full circle, actually. I've understood in a way in which I didn't before that I do have a responsibility. that what the position I find myself in gives me not just a responsibility, but perhaps even some of the tools to begin to say the things that need to be said. And A Home From Home, the book, was part of that.
Well, that's all from today's Haycast. If you've missed any of the other ones, you can listen to them at books.guardian.co.uk/hay2007/haycast. And so far, we've talked to Beryl Bainbridge, David Mitchell, Clive James, Kieran Desai, and so on. Tomorrow we have a kids programme. Mallory Blackman will be taking us around the children's bookshops, and we'll also be talking to Anne Fine. You can follow the Hay coverage online at guardian.co.uk/books/hay2007, and of course in the paper as well. I'm Safraz Manzor. The programme's been produced by Francesca Panetta. The music is by Kev Hopper. We're back tomorrow. Until then, it's goodbye.
Guardian Unlimited.